Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure this evening on behalf of the London School of Economics to welcome Professor Michael Walzer, whose work, or I should say more precisely, works are, I'm sure, well known to you all. Professor Walzer's reputation is in fields which are of great interest to the LSE and to many of us who teach and research here. He is, first of all, a political theorist, and the political theorist concerned with moral issues within what are called communities, within, more broadly, societies and states, but equally within the international as well. Not for him any of these trite departmental divisions between the domestic and the foreign with which we are sometimes concerned. In the field of international relations, one of the core books which our students study and which year after year changes the way in which they see the world is his work on just and unjust wars. But the central theme of that book, which is that any thinking about war involves moral claims and a moral vocabulary, is one which, of course, he has applied to other areas, all other areas of political life as well. Professor Walzer is also somebody who epitomizes a theme which I think is central to the LSE and which was at the core of Ralph Dahrendorf's book, which is the relationship between the academic world and the so-called, I stress, so-called real world, the non-academic world. And that relationship, as Dahrendorf so well expressed, is not one of choice. You don't choose to be in one or in the other. You don't have to make the choice. It's certainly not one of trying to reconcile them, which is an utterly foolish approach. It is one of permanent and creative tension. And while he is a professor in Princeton and is working on political theory, he is also the editor of a major intellectual journal of the liberal and socialist left in the United States, Dissent, and divides his time creatively and with much, I'm sure, tension between these two. But there's a third reason, I think too little mentioned sometimes here, which is that much of his work arises from and is a reflection upon moral and political issues within the United States and within the debates in the United States. I think it's often forgotten that many, in fact most, of the intellectual and political debates and many of the radical and alternative ideas which have concerned people in this country since the Second World War have not come from the continent of Europe or let alone from the Third World. They've come from debates within the United States, a society which, whatever else one can say, poses many questions in a very fertile way, and in which there is much reflection on them. And it is that we often get, as it were, the wrong end of American debates on political and moral theory, and it's a great pleasure, therefore, to have Professor Walzer today, who will give us, I think, a very different view of that. So for these three reasons alone, it gives me great pleasure indeed to introduce Michael Walzer. Thank you.
This paper that I'm going to mostly read this afternoon is an early version of a longer argument that I hope to make about toleration and multiculturalism, pluralism, coexistence. I'm not exactly sure what to call it, and as you'll see at the end, I'm not finished with thinking about what I want to say. So I hope that we'll have time when I'm finished for some discussion, arguments, questions. I'm not going to focus today, except maybe at the very end, on the toleration of eccentric or dissident individuals. Individual rights may well lie at the root of every sort of toleration, but I'm interested in those rights primarily when they are exercised in common, in the course of voluntary association or religious worship or cultural expression, or when they are claimed by groups on behalf of their members. The eccentric individual, solitary in his difference, is fairly easy to tolerate, and at the same time, social repugnance for or resistance to eccentricity, while certainly unattractive, isn't terribly dangerous. The stakes are much higher when we turn to eccentric and dissident groups. I'm also not going to focus this afternoon on political toleration, where the groups in question are oppositional movements and parties. These are competitors for political power. They are necessary in democratic regimes, which quite literally require that there be alternative leaders with alternative programs, even if they never actually win an election. They are fellow participants. They're like the members of the opposing team in a basketball game, without whom there couldn't be a game, and who therefore have a right to score baskets and win if they can. Problems arise only in the case of people who want to disrupt the game while still claiming the rights of players and the protection of the rules. These are often hard problems, but they don't have much to do with the toleration of political difference, which is intrinsic to the democratic idea. They have to do with the toleration of disruption, or the risk of disruption, which is another matter. So my concern here, what I do want to talk about, is toleration when the differences at stake are cultural, religious, way of life differences, and when the others are not fellow participants and there's no common game and no intrinsic need for difference. Even a liberal society doesn't require a multiplicity of ethnic groups or religious communities, nor do any of the groups require any or all of the others. The groups will often be competitive with one another, seeking converts or supporters among uncommitted or loosely committed individuals, but their primary aim is to sustain a way of life among their own members, reproducing their culture or faith in successive generations. They are, in the first instance, inwardly focused, which is exactly what political parties can't be or shouldn't be. And at the same time, they require some kind of extended social space outside the household for the sake of assembly, worship, argument, celebration, mutual aid, schooling, and so on. Now, what does it mean to tolerate groups of this kind? Understood as an attitude or state of mind, toleration describes a number of possibilities. The first of these, which reflects the origins of religious toleration in the 16th and 17th centuries, is simply a resigned acceptance of difference for the sake of peace. People kill one another for years and years, and then mercifully, exhaustion sets in, and we call this toleration. But we can trace a continuum of more substantive acceptances. A second possible attitude is passive, relaxed, benignly indifferent to difference. It takes all kinds to make a world. A third attitude expresses openness to the others, curiosity, perhaps even respect, a willingness to listen and learn. And furthest along the continuum, there is the enthusiastic endorsement of difference, an aesthetic endorsement. If difference is taken to represent in cultural form the largeness and diversity of the natural world, or a functional endorsement, if difference is viewed as a necessary condition of human flourishing, offering to individual men and women the choices that make their autonomy meaningful. But perhaps this last attitude, enthusiastic endorsement, falls outside my subject. How can I be said to tolerate what I endorse? If I want the others to be here in this society among us, then I don't tolerate otherness, I support it. But I don't, however, I don't necessarily support this or that version of otherness. I might well prefer another other. Culturally or religiously closer to my own practices and beliefs, or maybe more distant, exotic, posing no competitive threat. So it seems right to say that though I support the idea of difference, I tolerate the instantiated differences. And there will always be people in any democratic society, and however well entrenched the commitment to pluralism is, for whom some particular difference, this or that form of worship, family arrangement, sexual practice, dietary rule, or dress code is very hard to tolerate. I shall say of all people who actually accept differences of this sort, without regard to their standing on the continuum of resignation, indifference, curiosity, and enthusiasm, that they possess the virtue of tolerance. And similarly, I shall treat all the social arrangements through which we incorporate difference, coexist with it, allow it a share of social space as the institutionalized forms of this same virtue. Now, historically, there have been at least four, my list is not exhaustive, four, I want to talk about four different political arrangements that make for toleration, four models of a tolerant society, four regimes of toleration. I'm going to describe these briefly and a little roughly, and then say something about the self-understandings of the men and women who make them work today, insofar as they work. Toleration is always a precarious achievement. What exactly do we do when we tolerate difference? The oldest arrangements are those of the great multinational empires, beginning, for my purposes this afternoon, with ancient Persia and Rome. Here, the various groups are constituted as autonomous communities, political, legal, as well as cultural, religious, and character, ruling themselves across a considerable range of their activities. The groups have no choice but to coexist with one another because their interactions are governed by imperial bureaucrats in accordance with an imperial code, like the Roman Jus Gentium, designed to maintain some minimal fairness, as fairness is understood in the imperial center. Ordinarily, however, the bureaucrats don't interfere in the internal life of the autonomous communities for the sake of fairness or anything else, so long as taxes are paid and peace maintained. Hence, they can be said to tolerate the different ways of life, and the imperial regime can be called a regime of toleration, whether or not the members of the different communities are tolerant of one another. Under imperial rule, these members manifest tolerance willy-nilly in their everyday interactions, and some of them perhaps learn to accept difference, standing somewhere on the continuum that I have described. But the survival of the different communities doesn't depend on this acceptance. It depends only on bureaucratic toleration, sustained mostly for the sake of peace. Though individual bureaucrats have been variously motivated, a few of them, some Roman, some British, are famously curious about difference or even enthusiastic in its defense. If they get too enthusiastic, they are said to have gone native. Now, this is historically the most successful way of incorporating difference and facilitating or perhaps requiring peaceful coexistence. But it isn't, or at least it never has been, a democratic way. Whatever the character of the different autonomies, the incorporating regime is autocratic. And I don't want to idealize this autocracy. It can be brutally repressive for the sake of maintaining its conquests, as the history of Babylonia and Israel, Rome and Carthage, Spain and the Aztecs, Russia and the Tatars, and many, many other cases amply demonstrates. But settled imperial rule is often tolerant, and tolerant precisely because it is everywhere autocratic, which is to say not bound by the interests or prejudices of any of the conquered groups, equally distant from all of them. Roman proconsuls in Egypt or British regents in India ruled more even-handedly than any local prince or tyrant was likely to do, more even-handedly than local majorities today are likely to do. But imperial autonomy tends to lock individuals into their communities and therefore into a singular ethnic or religious identity. It tolerates groups. Groups are the object of toleration in multinational empires, not groups and their authority structures and their traditional elites and their customary practices. It doesn't tolerate, except in a few cosmopolitan centers and capital cities, free-floating men and women. Lonely dissidents or heretics, cultural vagabonds, intermarried couples and their children will flee to the imperial capital, which is likely to become, as a result, a fairly tolerant place and the only place where social space is measured to an individual fit. Think of Rome, Baghdad, Vienna, or perhaps better, Budapest. Everyone else outside of cities like that will live in homogeneous neighborhoods or districts, tolerated there, but not likely to be welcome or even safe across whatever line separates them from the others. They can mix comfortably only in neutral space, in the market, say, or the imperial courts and prisons. Still, they live most of the time in peace alongside one another, respectful of cultural as well as geographic boundaries. Today, all that is gone, or mostly gone. The Soviet Union was the last of the great multinational empires. The autonomous institutions, the carefully preserved boundaries, the ethnically marked identity cards, the far-flung bureaucracies. Autonomy didn't mean much at the end, which is one reason, perhaps, for imperial collapse. Its scope was greatly reduced by the impact of modern ideas about sovereignty and by totalizing ideologies uncongenial to the accommodation of difference. But ethnic and religious differences survived, and wherever they were territorially based, local agencies, more or less representative, retained some minimal functions and some symbolic authority. These they were able to convert very quickly once the empires fell into a kind of state machinery driven by nationalist ideology aiming at sovereign power. With sovereignty, if they achieve sovereignty, comes membership in international society. That's the most tolerant of all societies, though not one that I'm going to talk about today. The most tolerant of all societies, but until very recently, not so easy to get into. I'm not going to focus on international society, but it's important to say at least this, that this is where and how most groups would prefer to be tolerated. As nation states or religious republics with governments, armies, and borders, coexisting with other nation states in mutual respect, or at least under the rule of a common, even if rarely enforced, set of laws. Before I consider the nation state as a possibly tolerant society, I want briefly to turn to a morally closer but not politically more likely heir to the multinational empire, and that is the consociational or bi or tri-national state. Examples like Switzerland, Cyprus, Lebanon, and the stillborn Bosnia suggest the range of possibility here and also the imminence of disaster. Consociationalism is a heroic program, since it aims to maintain imperial coexistence without the imperial bureaucrats and without the distance that made those bureaucrats more or less impartial rulers. Now the different groups are not tolerated by a single transcendent power. They have to tolerate one another. They have to work out among themselves the terms of their coexistence. That's not impossible. Success is most likely where there are only two groups, roughly equal, either in size or political power, and where the equality is stable over time. Then the proportionate allocation of material resources and offices in the civil service is relatively easy, and neither group need fear the dominance of the other. Each pursues its own customs, perhaps even enforces its own customary law, undisturbed. It's the fear of disturbance, it's the fear of domination by the other group that breaks up consociations. Mutual toleration depends on trust, not so much in each other's goodwill as in the institutional arrangements that guard against the effects of ill will. I can't live tolerantly alongside a dangerous other. What's the danger that I fear? That the consociation will collapse into an ordinary nation state where I will be a member of the minority looking to be tolerated by my former associates who no longer require my toleration. Most of the states that make up international society are nation states. To call them that doesn't mean that they have nationally or ethnically or religiously homogeneous populations. Homogeneity is rare, perhaps non-existent in the world today. It means only that a single dominant group, the Norwegians in Norway, the French in France, and so on, organizes the common life in a way that reflects its own history and culture, and if things go as intended, carries the history forward, sustains the culture. It's these intentions that determine the character of public education, the symbols and ceremonies of public life, the state calendar, and the holidays it enjoins. Among histories and cultures, the nation-state is not neutral. Its state apparatus is an engine for national reproduction. At the same time, nonetheless, it can, and liberal and democratic nation-states commonly do, tolerate minorities. This toleration takes different forms, though it rarely reaches to the full autonomy of the old empires. Regional autonomy is especially unlikely, for then members of the dominant nation living in the region would be subjected to alien rule in their own country. Toleration in nation states is commonly focused not on groups, but on members of groups, minorities, conceived stereotypically, qua members, and allowed or even expected to form voluntary associations, organizations for mutual aid, private schools, cultural societies, publishing houses, and so on. They are not allowed to sustain a corporate existence or exercise legal jurisdiction over their fellows. Minority religion, culture, and history are matters for what might be called the private collective, about which the public collective, the nation state, is always suspicious. Any claim to act out minority culture in public is likely to produce anxiety among the majority, hence the controversy in France about the wearing of Muslim headdress in state schools. In principle, there's no coercion of individuals, but pressure to assimilate to the dominant nation, at least with regard to public practices, has been fairly common and, until recent times, quite successful. When 19th century German Jews described themselves as German in the street, Jewish at home, they were aspiring to a nation-state norm that made privacy a condition of toleration. The politics of language is one key area where this norm is both enforced and challenged. The majority insists that all minorities learn and use the language of the dominant nation, at least in their public transactions. Minorities, if they are strong enough, and especially if they are territorially based, will seek the legitimation of their own languages in schools, state documents, public signage, and so on. Sometimes one of the minority languages is recognized as a second official language. More often, the dominant nation watches its own language being transformed by minority use, which is also, I suppose, a test of toleration. Think of the struggles of the French Academy to prevent the introduction of American, or what's more serious, Arabic words into the French language. There's less room for difference in nation states than in multinational empires or consociations. Since the tolerated members of the minority group are also citizens with rights and obligations, the practices of the group are more likely than in multinational empires to be subject to majority scrutiny. Nonetheless, a variety of differences, especially religious differences, have been successfully sustained in liberal and democratic nation states. Minorities often, in fact, do fairly well in sustaining a common culture precisely because they are under pressure from the national minority. Individuals may drift away, pass themselves off as members of the majority, or slowly assimilate to majority lifestyles. But for most people, those self-transformations are too difficult or too humiliating. And so they cling to their own identities and to similarly identified men and women. National rather than religious minorities are the groups most likely to find themselves at risk in nation states. If they are territorially concentrated, they will be suspected, perhaps rightly, of hoping for a state of their own or for incorporation into a neighboring state where their ethnic relatives hold sovereign power. In time of war, whether they are territorially concentrated or not, their loyalty to the nation state will readily be called into doubt, even against all available evidence, as in the case of anti-Nazi German refugees in France during the first months of the Second World War. Once again, toleration fails when the others look, or when nationalist demagogues can make them look, dangerous. The fate of Japanese Americans, only a few years later, makes the same point. Their fellow Americans imitated conventional nation statehood. In fact, the Japanese were not, and are not today, a national minority in the United States, at least not in the usual sense of that term. For where is the majority nation? American majorities are temporary in character, differently constituted for different purposes and occasions, whereas a crucial feature of the nation state is its permanent majority. Toleration in nation states has only one source, moves or doesn't move in only one direction. The case of the United States suggests a different set of arrangements. The fourth model of coexistence and possible toleration is the immigrant society. Now the members of the different groups have left their territorial base, their homeland behind them, have come individually or in families, one by one, to a new land, and then dispersed across it. They cluster for comfort only in relatively small numbers, always intermixed with other similar groups in cities, states, and regions. Hence, no sort of territorial autonomy is possible. Quebec is the obvious exception here, and another exception should be made, though I'm not going to be able to elaborate on it today, for conquered Aboriginal peoples. But I'm going to focus now primarily on the immigrants. If ethnic and religious groups in an immigrant society are to sustain themselves, they have to do so as voluntary associations, which means that they are more at risk from the indifference of their own members than from the intolerance of the others. The state wants its pride loose from the grip of the first immigrants, who imagined in every case that they were forming a nation state of their own. The state is committed to none of the groups that make it up. It is, in the current phrase, neutral among them, tolerant of all of them, autonomous in its own purposes. The state claims exclusive jurisdictional rights regarding all its citizens as individuals rather than as members of groups. Now, the objects of toleration, strictly speaking, are individual choices and performances, acts of adhesion, participation in rituals of membership and worship, enactments of cultural difference, and so on. Individual men and women are encouraged to tolerate one another as individuals. Difference being understood now as a personalized rather than a stereotypical version of group culture, which also means that the members of each group, if they are to display the virtue of toleration, must accept each other's different versions of what it means to be a member of that group. Everyone has to tolerate everyone else. No group, this is an ideal type now that I'm describing, not a picture of, not a portrait of American society. No group is allowed to organize itself coercively or to seize control of public space, or to monopolize public resources. In principle, the public schools teach the history and civics of the state, which is conceived to have not a national, but only a political identity. The history and culture of the different groups is either not taught at all, or it is taught, as in the United States in recent times and in a few places, in equal doses, that is, multiculturally. Similarly, the state provides no help to any group, or it is equally supportive of all of them, encouraging, for example, a kind of general religiosity, as in those subway and bus advertisements of the 1950s that I remember vividly that urged Americans to attend the church of your choice. As this last maxim suggests, neutrality is always a matter of degree. Some groups are in fact favored over others, in this case groups with churches. But the others are still tolerated. Nor is church attendance or any other culturally specific practice made into a condition of citizenship. It's relatively easy then, and not at all humiliating, to escape one's own group and to take on the reigning political identity, that is, to become an American. But many people in an immigrant society prefer a hyphenated or dual identity, differentiated along cultural political lines, as in, say, Italian American. The hyphen joining the two symbolizes the acceptance of Italianness by other Americans, the recognition that American is a political identity without strong, or at least without specific, cultural claims. The consequence, of course, is that Italian is a cultural identity without political claims. That's the only form in which Italianness is tolerated, and then it must sustain itself, if it can, or as long as it can, privately, through the voluntary efforts and contributions of committed Italians. And this is the case, in principle, again, with every cultural and religious group, not only with minorities, but there is no permanent majority. Whether groups can sustain themselves under these conditions, without autonomy, without access to state power or official recognition, without a territorial base or the fixed opposition of a permanent majority, that's a question still to be answered. Religious communities of both sectarian and churchly sorts have not done badly in the United States up until now, but one reason for their relative success, it might be thought, is the considerable intolerance that many of them have in fact encountered, which often has, as I said a moment ago, group-sustaining effects. The form of toleration characteristic of immigrant societies is still emerging. It's not yet fully realized. We might think of this form, the toleration of individual choices and personalized versions of culture and religion, as the maximal or the most intensive kind of toleration. And again, it is still radically unclear whether the long-term effect of this maximalism will be to foster or dissolve group life. Now, let me summarize the argument so far by considering these four regimes, first in terms of the power relations they involve, and then in terms of the range of morally problematic practices they are prepared to tolerate. It's often said that toleration is necessarily a relationship of inequality, where the tolerated groups or individuals are cast in an inferior position. Therefore, we should aim at something better, beyond toleration, something like mutual respect. But once we've mapped out the four regimes, the story looks more complicated. Mutual respect is one of the forms that toleration can take. It may be the most attractive form, but it's not necessarily the most stable. So let's look at the power relationships. In multinational empires, power rests obviously at the center with the bureaucrats who represent the center. All the incorporated groups are encouraged to regard themselves as equally powerless, hence incapable of coercing or persecuting their neighbors. Any local attempt at coercion will produce an appeal to the center. So Greeks and Turks, for example, live peacefully side by side under Ottoman rule? Were they mutually respectful? Well, some of them probably were, and many were not. But the character of their relationship did not depend on their mutual respect. It depended on their mutual subjection. Consociation, by contrast, is more egalitarian, and so it requires respect, at least among the leaders of the different groups. For the groups must not only coexist, but negotiate among themselves the terms of their coexistence. Cyprus, before its partition into Greek and Turkish states, represents a failed example. In nation states, power rests with the majority nation, which uses the state, as we have seen, for its own purposes. The Norwegian state is an engine for the reproduction of Norwegianness. That was the purpose of separating from Sweden. That's what the state is for. This is no necessary bar to mutuality among individuals and among majority and minority individuals. And mutuality is likely to flourish in liberal democratic states. But minority groups are unequal by virtue of their numbers, simply, and will be democratically overruled on most matters of public culture. The case is similar early on in the history of immigrant societies when the first immigrants, who are really colonists, aspire to nation statehood. Successive waves of immigration produce what is, in principle, a neutral state, the democratic version of imperial bureaucracy. But this state addresses itself to individuals rather than groups, and so creates an open society in which, as I said, everyone is required to tolerate everyone else. The much heralded move beyond toleration is presumably now possible. It remains unclear, however, how much of group difference is still there to be respected once this move is made. Now, let's look at the four regimes in terms of how tolerant they are of morally problematic practices. And here, toleration is no doubt widest in the case that I'm not considering, and that is international society, where no one is authorized to decide whether to tolerate this group or practice. International law legitimates humanitarian intervention by any capable state in cases of massacre, enslavement, mass deportation, ethnic cleansing. Hence, we can say that these practices, in principle, are not tolerated. And whenever there is an actual intervention, which is not very often, we can say that they are, in fact, not tolerated. But in general, the agents of international society, political leaders and diplomats, and perhaps also the people they claim to represent, are remarkably tolerant of what goes on across their borders, are remarkably tolerant of what goes on the other side. They are resigned, indifferent, curious, or enthusiastic. It hardly matters. They are disinclined to interfere. It may be the case that they are hostile to their neighbors' culture and customs, but given the conditions of international society, are unprepared to pay the costs of interference, which involve raising an army, crossing a border, shedding blood. Or, though culturally intolerant, they may accept the logic of sovereignty, which decrees a kind of institutional toleration. Among the four political regimes, the multinational empire comes closest to accepting a similar logic. For the autonomous communities have different laws and legal systems, and until their members interact with the members of other communities, in commerce, for example, they are likely to be allowed to enforce their own shared understandings of lawful behavior. Strange commercial customs won't be tolerated in the common markets, but there won't be much interference in the work of local courts dealing, say, with domestic affairs. Consider, for example, the extraordinary reluctance with which the British finally, in 1829, banned the sati, the self-immolation of a Hindu widow on her husband's funeral pyre in their Indian states. For many years, first the East India Company and then the British government tolerated the practice because of what a 20th century historian calls their declared intention of respecting both Hindu and Muslim beliefs and allowing the free exercise of religious rights. Even Muslim rulers who had, according to this same historian, no respect whatsoever for Hindu beliefs, made only sporadic and half-hearted efforts to suppress the practice. Imperial toleration, then, extends as far as the sati, which, given British descriptions of what that practice actually involved, is pretty far. It's at least conceivable that consociational arrangements might produce a similar toleration, if the power of the joined communities was in near balance and the leaders of one of them were strongly committed to this or that customary practice. A nation state, however, where power is by definition unbalanced, would not tolerate customs like the sati among a national or religious minority. Nor is that toleration likely in an immigrant society where each of the groups is a minority relative to all the others. The case of the Mormons in the United States and of polygamy suggests that deviant practices won't be tolerated even when they are, as the Mormons claimed, wholly internal, involving only domestic life. In these last two cases, the state grants equal citizenship to all its members, including Hindu widows and Mormon wives, and then enforces a single law. There are no communal courts. The whole country is one jurisdiction where state officials are bound to stop a sati in progress in exactly the same way that they are bound to stop a suicide attempt if they possibly can. And if the sati is coercively assisted, as it often was, in fact, they have to treat the coercion as murder. There are no religious or cultural excuses. In other sorts of cases where the moral values of the larger community are not so directly challenged, religious or cultural excuses may be accepted and non-standard practices tolerated. Thus, the case of narrowly constituted or sectarian minorities like the American Amish or the Hasidim, to whom state authorities are sometimes ready to offer or the courts to mediate one or another compromise arrangement. The separation of the sexes in school buses, for example, for the Hasidim, or the reduction in the term of required education for the Amish. But similar concessions won't be offered to larger, more powerful groups, and even the standing compromises can always be challenged by any sect member who claims his or her citizen rights. Imagine that an arrangement is worked out allowing Muslim girls, as I think it should be worked out, allowing Muslim girls in French public schools to wear their customary headdress. And then, well, this would be a compromise with the laicist traditions of French education, but those traditions would continue to govern the school calendar and the curriculum. At some point, let's say, a number of Muslim girls claim that they are being coerced by their families to wear the headdress, and that the compromise arrangement facilitates this coercion and makes the state complicitous in it. Then, it seems to me, the compromise would have to be renegotiated. In the nation state and the immigrant society, though not in the multinational empire, the right to be protected against coercion of this kind would take precedence over the family values of the minority religion or culture. Well, I've talked about some of the limits of toleration, but I haven't said anything about regimes of intolerance, which is what many empires and nation states actually are. These sometimes succeed in obliterating difference, but sometimes when they stop short of genocide and mass deportation, they serve, in fact, to reinforce it. They mark off the members of minority groups, they persecute them because of their membership, they compel them to rely on one another, they forge intense solidarities. Nonetheless, neither the leaders of such groups nor their most committed members would choose to live under a regime of intolerance. Given the opportunity, they will seek some form of individual or collective toleration. That is, they will seek assimilation into the body of citizens or recognition of their standing in domestic or international society. We might think of these two, individual assimilation and group recognition, as the central projects of modern democratic politics. They are standardly conceived in mutually exclusive terms. Either individuals or groups will be liberated from persecution and invisibility, and individuals only insofar as they abandon their groups. Thus, Jean-Paul Sartre's description of the prototypical Democrat's view of the Jewish question. This is from his book, Anti-Semite and Jew. He, the Democrat, says Sartre, wants to separate the Jew from his religion, from his family, from his ethnic community, in order to plunge him into the democratic crucible, whence he will emerge naked and alone, an individual and solitary particle, just like all the other particles. Well, this project can obviously be described in a more positive way, but since it's not my subject this afternoon, I'm not going to say anything more about it. The alternative to this kind of assimilation is to provide the group as a whole with a voice, a place, and a politics of its own. If the first project was once thought on the political left to require a struggle for inclusion on the model of the working class and socialist movement, forming and breaching the walls of the bourgeois city, the second project, the struggle for group recognition, requires boundaries, requires a recognition, an acceptance, of a fashioning of boundaries. And the crucial slogan of this second struggle is self-determination, which implies the need for a piece of territory, or, it doesn't have to be territory, a set of independent institutions. Hence, decentralization, devolution, autonomy, partition, and so on. Getting the boundaries right, not only in geographic but also in functional terms, is enormously difficult, but necessary if the different groups are to exercise significant control over their own lives and to do so with some security. This work goes on today, adapting the old imperial arrangements, extending the modern international system, proliferating nation states and self-governing regions and distinct societies and local authorities, and so on. But note what's being recognized and tolerated here. It is always groups and their members, men and women conceived to have singular or primary identities, ethnic or religious in character. The work obviously depends upon the mobilization of these people, but it's only their leaders who are actually engaged with one another across boundaries one-on-one. For the mass of group members, toleration is maintained by separation on the assumption that these people understand themselves as members and want to associate mostly with one another. Good fences, as the American poet Robert Frost said, good fences make good neighbors. The last of my toleration models, however, points toward a different pattern and perhaps a postmodern project. In immigrant societies, and also now in nation states under immigrant pressure, people begin to experience what we might think of as a life without boundaries and without secure or singular identities. Difference is, as it were, dispersed so that it's encountered everywhere, every day. Individuals mix but don't necessarily assimilate to a common identity. The hold of groups on their members is looser than it has ever been, though by no means broken entirely. And the result is a constant commingling of ambiguously identified individuals, intermarriage among them, and hence a literal multiculturalism, instantiated not only in the society as a whole, but in each and every family, even in each and every individual. Now, tolerance begins at home, where we often have to make ethnic, religious, and cultural peace with our spouses, in-laws, and children, and with our own hyphenated or divided selves. Religious fundamentalism, I think, is best understood as a rejection of any such peace, an attack on postmodern ambiguity. The Bulgarian-French writer Julia Kristeva has been one of the important theoretical defenders of this postmodern project, urging us to recognize a world of strangers and to acknowledge the stranger in ourselves. In addition to a psychological argument, which I will pass by here, she restates a very old moral argument, whose first version is the biblical injunction, "Do not oppress the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." Kristeva changes the verb tense and the geography for the sake of a contemporary reiteration. Do not oppress the stranger, for you are strangers in this very land. Surely it's easier to tolerate otherness if we acknowledge the other in ourselves. I doubt, however, that this acknowledgement is sufficient by itself or in a merely moral form. We don't live in the world of strangers all the time. We don't live in the postmodern world all the time, nor do we encounter each other's strangeness only one-on-one, but also still collectively, in situations where morality and personal relations must be seconded by politics. It's not the case that the postmodern project simply supersedes modernism, as in some grand meta-narrative of historical stages. The one is superimposed on the other without in any way obliterating it. There still are boundaries, but they are blurred by all the crossings. We still know ourselves to be this or that, but the knowledge is newly uncertain because we are also this and that. Strong identity groups exist and assert themselves politically, but the allegiance of their members is measured by degrees along a broad continuum with larger and larger numbers clustered at the farther end, which is why the militants at the near end are so strident these days. This dualism of the modern and the postmodern requires that difference be doubly accommodated, first in its singular individual and collective versions, that is, through the assimilation of groups into the democratic public and the assimilation of individuals into the democratic public and the recognition of groups and therefore the multiplication of publics, has to be, those two must be accommodated, and also all the pluralist, dispersed, and divided versions of contemporary life have to be accommodated. And I'm not sure in what sequence that accommodation occurs. I'm not arguing. I'm not committed to a sequential argument. We need to be tolerated and protected as citizens and members, and also as strangers. Self-determination has to be both political and personal. The two are related, but they're not the same. The old understanding of difference, which tied individuals to their autonomous or sovereign groups, will be resisted now by dissident and ambivalent individuals. But any new understanding focused solely on the dissidents will be resisted by men and women struggling to enact, elaborate, revise, and pass on a common religious or cultural tradition. And so difference must be twice tolerated, with whatever mix, and it doesn't have to be the same mix in both cases, of resignation, indifference, curiosity, and enthusiasm. Even those of us who are enthusiasts are bound to come up against differences, cultural and personal, that give us trouble. For we don't want to tolerate hatred and cruelty, nor does our respect for difference extend to oppressive practices within groups which were commonly tolerated by imperial bureaucrats. Nor does it reach to radically dissociated and irresponsible individuals. The more closely we live together, the more the limits of toleration become everyday issues. and closeness is one of the aims of the postmodern project. And so all the solid lines on the old cultural and political maps are turned into dotted lines. But coexistence along and across those lines is still a problem. I hope to have more to say about that problem before I finish writing this book on toleration. Thank you.
For a very stimulating talk. As you were reflecting on the first of your four regimes of tolerance, I was reminded that two of the great voices who from the LSE developed their critiques of nationalism, Elie Kaddouri and Ernest Gellner, both did so by some retrospective reference to previous multinational empires, in Kaddouri's case the Ottoman, in Ernest's case the Austro-Hungarian, and of course one of Ernest's great sayings was, better Franz Josef than Josef, which I think was a tribute to that particular multinational regime. We have 10 minutes for questions, so would you like to fill them
yourself?
Sure, fine. Okay,
sure.
Off we go. Right. And don't forget.
Yes.
There was one point in your talk where you mentioned that toleration prevails when nationalist demagogues make other groups look different. And that's the only time I got any sense of where intolerance is coming from in your model. Maybe I'm just missing a point, but do you see sort of intolerance as the norm and tolerance as a kind of apology that we have to introduce? Or where exactly does intolerance come from?
Well, I think it has many sources, and I'm not going to speculate on its sources in human nature. Because there are very old and fairly obvious answers to that, to the question, what are the sources in human nature? I think that I lean toward a Hobbist account of intolerance and group conflict, partly because it's the account that opens the way best for a political response. And the Hobbist account is that aggression stems from fear, and that groups are most likely to mobilize themselves for war against the other when they are fearful of their own survival or well-being, when they imagine themselves threatened. And that's what I said, the passage you quoted, it's when nationalist demagogues succeed in making the other seem threatening that intolerance becomes a danger. And therefore, one solution for intolerance is to find some way to guarantee the security of both ethnic minorities and majorities, and that is the project that I described as one of the modern projects. That is if you take an easy example, the Quebecers are intolerant of Anglophones in their province because they fear, and it's not an illegitimate fear, that they will not be able to sustain a French culture in the middle of English, of Canada as an English-speaking society and an immigrant society. And one way of dealing with that, which is the way that some of my friends on the sort of the Canadian social democrats, liberal social democrats, is to try to devise a constitutional status for Quebec within the Canadian Union that will guarantee the special cultural character of that of that province. And that is a, now there are many other arguments. I mean, religious intolerance may well have other sources. It may arise from the belief that God is displeased with everyone in the world but us, and that's not that doesn't lend itself to the same kind of political response. People with views of that sort have to be defeated politically, not accommodated. Yes?
I'm not quite convinced. I mean, this is exactly the problem that continues to come up against differences which we find very hard to tolerate. It's exactly the point about headdresses. It even becomes a problem here at this very institution where people are being forced to put them on. Could you elaborate on how to deal with the differences we actually find difficult to tolerate?
Well, I need an example. The headdress of Muslim girls in French state schools is intolerable to lay secular French Republicans in the Jacobin tradition, the Jacobin tradition was intolerant from day one. It was intolerant of Catholicism long before it became intolerant of Islam. And one of the reasons for the failure of the revolution and the terrorism that it produced was precisely this intolerance. So, it does seem to me that the French state ought to accommodate, simply ought to say, okay, come to school the way you want to come to school. Now, that is a response to the French Republican objections. The French feminist objections have a different form. They say these girls are not choosing to wear the headdress. They are being coerced into wearing it. And it is the duty of a secular regime to free them from that coercion. But that doesn't mean forcing them not to wear it, which seems the equivalent of forcing them to wear it. So there is a bind here, which I confess I'm not sure how to deal with. But I suspect that making it possible for those parents to send that child to a state school by allowing them to force the headdress on her is better than banning the headdress and leading them to create separatist parochial schools in which the opportunity of the child to find her own way in a wider world is radically diminished. So you muddle through in these, you compromise, you make the best arrangement that you can reach. But what I find, I don't admire the fierce hostility to religion in the Jacobin tradition. That is as intolerant as much of the religious, in fact, it is the mirror image of the religious tradition that it is opposing. In the back, yeah. Yes, the argument is that stability in consociational societies might be better if there is a dominant group. That's true, I suppose. Except then the consociation isn't a isn't perfectly consociational. It is in part domination rather than consociation. If the minority group accepts its position, and if the majority group, the dominant group, actually does share resources and offices in the civil service on some at least proportional, then a consociation might work and might be stable on those grounds. The difficulty arises when the smaller group has a higher birth rate than the larger group, or when there is immigration from the larger group and the proportions start to change. That's what happened in Lebanon, and it makes for radical instability and great danger, and presses toward a nation state model, I think. Yes. Yes, but I don't know.
The conflict in Bosnia, the main state has itself had been the authoritarian.
Well, what happened there was the collapse of the empire. I mean, Yugoslavia was an empire. It was a multinational empire, and it was made possible by the rule of communist bureaucrats. And when the bureaucrats disappeared or collapsed, then a consociation among those groups proved to be impossible. It is a negotiated arrangement among the. Look, this has happened again and again. It is the most common way in which these kinds of interethnic wars arise. The disappearance of the power, the external power that stood in the way. Greeks and Turks lived in adjacent villages in Asia Minor for centuries, often on different sides of the same village for centuries, in peace with one another, because they were ruled by bureaucrats from somewhere else. But when they had to decide which of them should rule, how rule should be divided among them when the external power disappeared, the coexistence was, I'm not going to say impossible, because someone will turn up with a happy instance where it worked, but it is enormously difficult. This has to be troubling. It is democracy, or the need to establish some form of self-rule that makes for these difficulties. As Rousseau understood, democracy works best with homogeneous populations, except in the immigrant society. And what makes the immigrant society a possible democracy is that these people have all left their homelands behind them. It's because of the dispersed character of the differences that make that makes democracy possible. Should we? Okay.
Well, on behalf of all of us here in the London School of Economics, I'd like to thank Michael Walzer very much indeed for a very engaging lecture. When he began speaking of regimes of intolerance, I immediately began to think of the issue which most divides and most animates the community of the London School of Economics at the moment, which I perhaps would, taking his phrase, quoting it slightly different, say, you know, be kind to strangers, provided they don't come with a packet of cigarettes under their arm. Now, of course, this raises the question that many movements of intolerance are not just about moral outrage. They immediately come to concepts of threat, or indeed the very, very tendentious but prevalent concept of offense and what constitutes offense. And it's one of the many issues which he raised this evening, which I'm sure we'll reflect on in our different societies. But I think, as his lecture has so well shown, in a common moral and discursive realm that we all inhabit, everything that he said, I think, meant something to all of us, whichever country and culture or even group we come from. And it was part of the richness of his talk that it should do so. Thank you very much indeed.